Yeah,
how's it going?
It's going well. I appreciate you making the time and having me on.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming on, man. I appreciate it. I'm always trying to show mortgage brokers, real estate brokers, that there are other ways in real estate to make money that don't make you a slave to your phone or to needy clients.
That's right.
you know, so
possible.
It's very possible. So I'm super excited to have you talk about what you're doing, man. You know, we're in a community together, right? We're in a mastermind. We kind of do the same thing, but different asset classes. So, yeah, man. So I'll just, you know, Jordan, let you go ahead and, if you don't mind, introduce yourself, give a little spiel about what you do. And otherwise, I try to keep these, I didn't prepare for this at all. So I just like to have a freewheeling discussion about the things we do, man. So,
well, yeah, no, and I appreciate it. I look forward to hearing more about you as well. But Jordan Da Silva, I am the CEO of Web City Properties. Our company has been around since 2005. My dad, John Da Silva, started the company back then. He originally was from India, came to California, started doing investing. He originally, you know, very poor background, but started a manufacturing company. And then he saw somebody driving a Mercedes across the street from his manufacturing facility. He was like, well, what do you do for a living? And of course, that person said real estate, and the rest is history, as they say. So he immediately wanted to get into real estate, read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, read Think and Grow Rich, all these books that inspired him to figure out that real estate was the means of creating generational wealth. And so he did that. He started buying apartment buildings out in California, and then eventually transitioned to moving to Dallas, where we're at now, and started Web City Properties. And the model that, you know, he always went with, and that our company stays true to today, is going where no one else wants to go, and really investing in people that are left behind. And that's kind of the story of him as an immigrant and somebody that had a poor background that no one kind of thought he could get to where he ended up getting to. But the model in Dallas that really allowed our company to grow was, you know, this is way back in right after the recession is really when it really started to ramp up in that 09, 10, 11, 12 era. He would buy single family homes, say for 5, 10, 15,000 in Dallas, mostly in the southern sector of Dallas in the poorest areas. He would rehab them, do light rehabs, and then he would sell or finance them to a buyer who couldn't get a conventional loan. So a riskier buyer, but they had income to qualify, and they would kind of get a second chance in owning a home. And so did that for about almost 15 years. And really, it was the note business. We originated and serviced the notes, and great cash flowing notes. You didn't get the upside, but you were kind of downside protected with that note. And you gave access to home ownership to hundreds of people that normally wouldn't have been able to access it. So, you know, in a roundabout way, it was an impactful model of growing a business and helping the community in Southern Dallas. And as the community grew and as Dallas as a whole grew, you know, we benefited from that as well by acquiring long-term rentals. Now, fast forward to today, unfortunately, my dad passed away in 2020. And I took over at 23 and, you know, kind of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, as they say, and 1 year out of college, actually. So 1 year of experience working under him, learned a lot. And then I took over and right at that 2020 period where COVID happened and then the market just exploded as interest rates were cut, you know, had to figure out where do we want to take this company. We had a lot of long-term rentals. We had a lot of single family notes as well, but really wanted to scale. And so it took me about a year and a half, you know, really towards the end of 2021, early 2022, when I figured out that we wanted to pivot to multifamily. So we decided to pivot to multifamily late 21, early 22. We've acquired a 12 unit in early 22. We partnered on a 96 unit deal in Waco, Texas. And then we're still acquiring single family homes at scale today. Looking for value add multifamily here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, looking for development opportunities, and really all with the thesis of wanting to make an impact while growing our company. And so we do property management in-house, construction management in-house. And we believe that that is a way to increase our impact by having a very tight presence in the community where we can make a difference. So That's what we're doing now. We're about 8 full-time employees, another 5 or 6 part-time, managing a little over 500 units or so, and continuing to acquire more. So that's where we're at, and we're excited to continue growing.
That's awesome, man. I'm sorry, about your father.
Thank you.
Yeah, wow, 23 years old, you had to step up and take over the family business, huh?
Certainly fortunate in that, he gave a great foundation and had a lot of great team members here. But it was definitely an experience at that age, trying to learn as much as I can, kind of drinking from a fire hose.
I'm sure. What were you studying in college?
I studied business, but certainly, that doesn't prepare you for the real world of entrepreneurship in just a year. So,
I could understand. Yeah,
a little bit different education.
Where were you going to? Where did you study at?
I went to the University of Oklahoma.
Okay.
Boomer Sooner.
Yeah, Boomer Sooner. Wow. How do your Texas friends feel about that?
You know what? They get it because it's a good school. Texas, especially on the sports side, right? Texas has been struggling in football, so I think they get it. But no, it was a good experience to kind of get out of Dallas for a little bit, have my own experiences. And I think it served me well coming back in and, bringing some of those experiences to managing this company.
So I also went to business school, and I think I was very fortunate in that I actually had a business at the time when I went. In fact, it was the reason I went. I had a gym, and I was a personal trainer who had a lease-based gym, right, and a bunch of equipment I owned. And I realized very quickly that I didn't really know anything about business, and so I had the GI Bill at my disposal. So I was like, well, I'll just go study business in school. See, I guess. That's what it's there for, right? I never understood it before that, like, a degree in business, like, it seemed like a Mickey Mouse degree to me.
Where did you go?
I went to University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
So I found it super useful, right? Learning accounting and how to read a P&L. But I consider myself fortunate because I had a business problem. And so I went to school looking for solutions to that and found a lot. Also found out I didn't want to be in the gym business. And
that's a good thing.
Kind of made my way into real estate. And I found it, I definitely have learned more since then, but it like really set a strong foundation for me. Like it just like a really strong kind of business, gave me, it started that like business mind, So I'm curious from your perspective. I mean, it sounds like you were not in business when you went to school. So did you take it seriously? Did you like business school? And do you find things that apply, now that really helped you? Or do you think that you could have done without it?
Well, I think it's funny that you say that you went to, business school after you had a business. I'm actually doing my MBA now at Southern Methodist University, which is in Dallas. I mean, it's a very real estate focused program. There's a lot of real estate people. And so I'm kind of going through the same thing you went through, as far as now I have a business to actually take through this MBA program. That's a real estate concentration too. So it's helping me figure out a lot of things when it comes to not just operating, but of course, underwriting, looking at your business, your real estate firm, as if it is like a larger institutional private equity firm. So that's been a different mindset shift that I don't think I had before this, because I'm interacting now with people that are working for large funds, big players, and I'm kind of bringing that mindset in. But to answer your other question, I think at OU, I was fortunate to start my own student organization, really be involved in my own thing. And I think it was good to, and I did take it seriously, it was good to just have that entrepreneurial spirit and be able to do it by myself without having my dad looking over my shoulder. And, you got to have that separation where you kind of can make your own mistakes and feel empowered to do things. So I enjoyed my undergraduate time. I think it's just two different journeys, but I certainly don't think I would have been able to take over and, do what I've been able to do without that previous experience where I had to figure things out for my own in college and learn my own thing.
Right on. That's another thing I noticed about business school too, is like a lot of the, when I was in the, before business school, right, you had to take a bunch of classes and, underwater basket weaving or whatever. And, the different kids, I was older, so I refer to them as kids a lot. No offense, but you know, the other guys I was in school with, once I actually made it to the major, they seemed a lot more serious. You know, the yeah. ones that were in the business major, they were like, "I'm here to learn how to make money." You know, it was pretty cool.
And so I'm interested to hear what was it that you were like, okay, fitness is not for me. After, like, what course did you take, or where was the enlightenment coming in?
You know, yeah. Once I made it through all the prereqs and got into actual, you know, learning business, there was also like business prerequisites that you had to take before you could even declare your specific business major. And I really fell in love with finance, really liked the finance stuff. And so I actually declared my major in finance and then picked up a second in entrepreneurship at the advice of a professor that I really liked and, you know, talked to him about it. Just going through all of that and seeing all of the opportunities out there to make money in business, particularly in like helping, you know, in finance is really strictly the study of making money with money, right? Like business yeah. management is more operational in dealing with people. Marketing is obviously more like psychological and getting people to click the button, buy now button or whatever, right? And finance is just more, you know, what's the return on investment? How do we make this money more money? And I just like that a lot. And I kind of realized that like helping other people become wealthy with their own money is probably is scalable infinitely. Whereas a gym owner, I ran into a lot of problems with scale. I thought I was a great trainer. I was passionate about fitness and just did a lot of self-learning. So I just understood the human body really well and I could help people really effectively, but there was only one of me. And so I ran into limitations in time. Plus I was obligated to be at a certain place at a certain time on a regular basis. Made it really hard to get away. The working hours were outside of people's normal working hours, right? So for me to help someone who could afford to pay me, they had to go to a job from 9 to 5. So I had to help them before or after that. So my mornings and evenings were gone, and that was most days of the week, and I couldn't make more of me. So I just kept running into like, I got really burnt out with the schedule and the lack of scalability in that business. And finance removed both of those problems, right? You can really do it from anywhere. Yeah. And there's not much of a limitation to how big you can grow it. So when I finished school, I actually just walked away from the gym. I gave my clients away. I worked out some deals for my equipment. And I just walked completely away from it to just figure out what I really wanted to do. And I ended up in mortgage yeah. lending for a while.
Good for you and making that bold decision and taking action.
Yeah, man, that was, yeah. So that was it, dude. Just trying to, and actually I didn't really learn anything about real estate in college.
They don't teach you too much in undergraduate, especially.
No, it's all about the stock market. It's all about, and like all of the same calculations are applicable to real estate. And when I got into mortgage lending and started applying the financial math I was privy to real estate, I was like, wait a minute, there's something going on here. You know, right. This is nuts, you know? So that's how I just ended up in real estate. I just saw the math when I was doing mortgages.
And I think, you know, I'm fortunate to be going to SMU. SMU is a real estate school. I mean, Dallas is a real estate town at the end of the day. You know, it's one of the premier real estate markets right now. But more than that, I think there's more real estate operators and professionals here than probably any other market, just because that's what's so heavy here in the industry wise. But so I'm fortunate to be at a school where there actually is a heavy real estate concentration, unlike I'm sure other schools that are more focused on finance applied to, you know, bonds, stocks, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. No, I think Texas in general is the hub for real estate investing. It's something unique, man, for sure. Yeah. I'm curious. I've had this question myself for a while. I actually don't know the answer. So when you're selling a home, seller finance, and you obviously you're holding the note, right? Let's just say for easy example, it's a 100K home and it's 100% seller financing. So you get no money at closing. You just get a promissory note. Now you're paying. There are no capital gains advantage to that. The interest is income. And I imagine there's a taxable event when you sold your home that could feasibly, if it's treated like a normal situation where you're not holding the note, right, all that capital gains is taxable, but you have no money to pay for it, right? Is that a real scenario, or how do you get around that capital gains problem in a seller?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a long-term capital gains, and as you pay it down over the years, or as it gets paid down, there's those increments of gain are taxed. And then whenever it gets paid off, of course, you have a larger taxable event. But I think, first of all, you volume takes care of a lot of things. And your splits, your margins are important, which is why the model doesn't work as much now, because the margins for flipping have just gone down so much, especially in this model. It's not a very, a lot of what we do was all cash based. There wasn't a ton of credit out there for this type of product, type of model we were doing in this area. There's a lot of hard money lending out there now, but it made more sense for us to do it on a cash basis during that time period of more volatility in the market. And so, I mean, you're buying, your all-in basis is like 50,000 and you're selling it for 120, 130, then you can, and you're getting a 5% down payment. Then when you do that at volume, you're able to, you have such good cash flow that you can pay for, whatever tax you get. So I think that's what made it work, especially in the early periods. Because it's crazy that you're able to buy things for $5,000, $10,000.
Yeah.
Way back when, right? So your basis is so low that if you have enough liquidity up front, you're not really struggling. I think, and I wish the model still worked, because it's such an impactful model, but a lot of it's impactful because now you have a lot of equity given to the homeowners who wouldn't be able to access homeownership before we came in the picture. But because now they have all this equity, then the cycle kind of ends, because everybody knows what the trajectory of Dallas and the southern sector is as well. So,
okay. It's tough. So to make sure I'm understanding this right, when you sell a house, seller finance, let's say you do it 100% seller financing, you're not actually, there's no taxable event until a principal payment is made.
That's right. Well, and as they're paying it off every year, you have that gain, which is, of course, the difference between your basis and what you sold it for, that is being taxed incrementally on the principal. That's every year. So it's a small amount. And then, of course, as you get payoffs, which we've had a lot of over the last couple of years, just because of the the debt situation, people were able to sell their houses for insane amounts. So
yeah,
we had a lot of payoffs in the last 3-4 years.
Those were all long term, even if you consummated the sale within that 1 year window.
Which you have to still sell after 1 year. So okay. We always would wait a year and then sell.
Gotcha.
I did a lot of rent to own, 6 month rent to own, RTOs back in the day as well, which helped us be able to accomplish that.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. When your dad was buying all these single family homes, was he using other people's money?
No, that's what's crazy about it. He started out his career, of course, having to use other people's money and buying mobile home parks, multifamily out in California, and unfortunately he lost a good amount of money doing that. Overlevered, the savings and loan crisis back in the 80s really took him out pretty hard. But he came back stronger, but he also came back more conservative and didn't want to. Especially after 2008, he was ready to be as conservative as possible and didn't want to take any investor money. So we're all, we currently have no outside investors in any of our properties, which is, a good and bad thing, right? It limits your scale, which is why we're now getting more multifamily, having to raise money. But with the current portfolio we have, it's nice to not have to answer to any other outside investors.
So how did you... So when he started in real estate, he did use other people's money to kind of get started. Sounds like he might have lost it all, or
yeah, he did well in the beginning, and then of course he had a tough time in the 80s and the savings and loan crisis, and so that definitely was tough for him. But he came back after that doing more small single family, so he was able to kind of build up another portfolio out in California without using investors' money. Kind of doing the Burr strategy, and then sold out in, kind of the peak before the GFC back in 2005, 2006. And then right as, you know, the cycle went back down again after,
after the PSC,
took all that money that is California money and put it in Texas real estate, which at the time, the splits, and even now still is so much different, right? Just moving, we had a three-bedroom, one-bath, small house that was, you know, worth $575K, and you buy a house for $500K, that's a McMansion out in Texas, right?
Right, so, right.
Translate that to buying single-family homes for $5K, $10K, then you already, the payoff that you have from selling off in California allows you to have so much more in Texas at the time.
Gotcha. That makes sense, man. So that sounds like a lot of years of really hard work and a couple doses of really good luck.
You know, timing is never, it's a little bit of luck, right? A lot of luck.
Yeah.
To get the timing right. But
that's so awesome.
He was pretty lucky there.
Did he see the crash coming? Or did he just, it was just part of his existing business plan and just so happened that the crash happened right after he exited everything?
No, I think it was really a product of some luck, maybe some foresight, but you know, at the time we actually moved for family reasons more than anything, because my mom's side of the family actually lives in Oklahoma. So we were out in California at the time and my grandfather had passed away, and so they wanted to move closer to be with my grandma, who's in Oklahoma. So we naturally were moving from California to Texas, and at the same time he was, you know, sell out of his California portfolio, start buying in Dallas. It was just perfect serendipity.
Wow. That is awesome, man. That's a really cool story. So you have 500 doors under management now.
Yeah. Single family notes and rentals. So a lot of it's not active management, luckily, but yeah, no, okay. We're very fortunate.
So 500 single family doors, a mix of notes and rentals that you own and manage.
That's right. Yeah. With full property management capacity. So
do the notes, are you actively managing those, the doors too? Or just the notes or a mix?
Yeah. We manage both the notes and the rentals. Obviously the notes, you know, more of the servicing and escrow payments, things of that nature. So not as much active, you know, work orders, turnovers, things of that nature, but we have around 130 doors that we actively property manage with work orders, maintenance, et cetera.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, of course you don't own the home when you hold a note, so you're not managing the home.
You still have to go through foreclosure process and collections. Sure. So it's definitely not, I wouldn't say it's passive fully.
No, I gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. And do you have, you mentioned some apartment buildings. Have you acquired, you've closed on a couple now?
Yeah, so we were co-GP on a 96-unit student housing deal in Waco. That's with another sponsor that we're kind of learning from and getting experience from there. Student housing certainly its own game to play, but been a great learning experience there. And then a 12-unit, which was like our first taste of multifamily out in, it's in Brock, Texas, which is about 40 minutes outside of Dallas, Fort Worth area. So kind of in a tertiary market, but 2019 build, great property. It's been really successful. So we're kind of just getting our taste, and then we're putting all the lines out to hopefully catch some big fish later this year and next year.
Sure. Is that 12 unit, did you buy that or did you syndicate it?
Bought that with a JV partner. The JV partner actually found the deal for us, and that's how they became partners with us. But we put in the majority of the equity.
Gotcha. All right. So with that 96 unit student housing deal, was that your first time? Is that your first time using raising other people's money?
Yeah, and you know, I didn't even have to raise too much, but just being in the presence of it and learning the process of going through a syndication, the timelines for raising, how each of these people were raising the deal, you know, raising for the deal from their various investors. So just learning the whole process of it was a great learning experience before I go into doing it myself.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So when did you close on that?
That was in July of last year. So it's been a learning experience. My role really is more on the boots on the ground asset management side. Mm-hmm. So I've been down there plenty of times, and I tell you what, student housing is a different beast than regular property management. It's definitely a lot more high touch, I guess is the word.
I imagine it is. You know, I have a, do you know who John Lane is?
Heard the name.
I got to link you up with him. I'm in an accountability group with him, but he is super hard into student housing as well out in Washington. So that could totally link you guys up. I think it'd be a good connection. But yeah. How is what are your thoughts a year in on student housing?
Yeah,
as an investment.
I'll say this, and this is more of a blanket statement, not about our property, but about the general market of student housing property management, at least in Waco, is that I think if somebody could come in and really be a great manager of student housing, then they could make a killing. I'll say that up front, just because the management is such a different game, like I said, as far as, you know, you have to be constantly pre-leasing. At all times, you're having to really be in touch with the student body, because you're always leasing for the next year, right? And so that to me is the biggest difference. It's not like the same cycle of single family homes or apartments, in that, you know, it's kind of transitory throughout the year. Of course, you have your hotter, you know, cycles during the year, but with student leasing, I mean, you got to be pre-leased for the following year, almost a 6 to 9 months beforehand, right? Because that's when students are making their decisions. And if you don't have that done by that time, you put yourself in a tougher position because the students have already made the decision. So you're kind of reaching a certain defined body of people that are making decisions in a certain time period. And if you don't really take advantage of that, you can kind of get left behind. So I think that's the urgency of student housing was the biggest revelation this past year, just understanding the differences between managing that and managing, you know, your average apartment building.
That makes sense. So are you getting in your, are you, does, do you partner with the university and basically get lists of everyone that's enrolled? And
I wish it was that easy. I wish it was easy. No, they're very, very much, they have their own housing, I should say. Right. And they're going to make you work for it. So you've got to be, you know, doing your own advertising events. It's a lot more outreach constantly, like I said, than just a regular apartment building, and the school is not very much help either. They don't want you advertising on campus. There's a lot of rules against that as well, so it makes it a little tough. But you know, everybody's kind of playing the same game, so you gotta just do what you gotta do.
That's next level. That is not just throw it up on the MLS and someone shows up and rents it.
Not at all.
Interesting. And
you're dealing with parents. Don't forget that. Dealing with parents who have kids who are moving out of, you know, on by themselves for the first time, potentially. So you get a lot of parents who are worried, and their kids don't know how to make decisions for themselves. So customer service is a needed skill when managing a student housing property.
Man, this is sounding a little bit like kind of crossing into my genre of short-term renting, where you're actually marketing before the arrival, and which is intensive, and the clientele you're dealing with is much more intensive than like a standard long-term tenant, man. Like but it's been there so much longer. It's like this interesting hybrid between the long-term and the short-term world.
Of course, you know, they're willing to pay more. Their decision making is different than an average. It's not always based on price. Actually, many times it's not based on price. It's based on, you know, location or amenities or what the friends are in the same place, right? So it pays itself off eventually, but definitely you have to have a different mindset when you're going into that kind of property.
So if you have to choose between the next investment being a multifamily of long term or a multifamily of student housing, what do you think you're going to go for?
Well, I think because we're in the mindset that we're going to manage whatever we buy next, and this is more of a learning experience, we're going to go for long term. We're not going for student. I do not want to be responsible for managing a student housing property. I think it's just, you know, I think if you're creating a property management company, I would invest in a property management company that would, excuse me, let me get a drinker. If there was a company out there that was going to disrupt the student housing property management space, I may invest in that company because there's a lot of opportunity. But for me personally, when buying and managing an asset, I'd much rather buy an asset where you can lease it year round and you don't have to deal with parents either. So that's my personal preference. But again,
that makes sense from an operator's perspective, for sure. Now, from an investor's perspective, right? If you got to choose between two passive investments, and as much being equal as possible, do you see a greater opportunity in student housing?
Actually, I see better. I think it depends on the market, right? You are starting to see enrollment numbers go up, but there's a lot of supply in, you know, various markets. I think it's all market specific. You know, some markets are being oversaturated with new student housing, luxury housing. Other markets don't have enough, right? So a lot of it's just market specific. Sorry, my throat is just killing me today. But no, I think personally, if I was going to be an LP, I would do student housing if I really knew the sponsor was experienced and the property management company had a great reputation for managing, because I think those are the two key things when managing a student or investing in a student housing deal, is making sure that there's some experience and some high competency. Because if you don't have those things, then you have a risk of vacancy and things going wrong with the property, right? Whereas a longer term rental in a great area, you know, you can have an average property manager, an average sponsor, and they can do well because the market's going to do well and property should kind of take care of itself a little bit. So I think there's just differences. You want to, if you're doing student housing, you better have a great operator, is what I would say.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, really cool. So I'm looking at this deal in College Station. I might actually be there in the next week or so. It's right nice. Down the road from Waco. If I come there, maybe we can.
Yeah, for sure.
Can link up, man, and get some.
And where are you based out of here? I don't know if you mentioned it.
Las Vegas. I'm in Las Vegas.
Oh, you're still in Las Vegas. Okay, nice.
Yeah, for now. I'll be out of here before too long, I think. It's hot here. I like Texas.
Yeah, but College Station, man, Texas A&M. That's a great school to be at. A great large student body, I would say.
Huge large student body, super central, right? Like all the main. Yeah. You got the San Antonio, Houston, Dallas, Austin, right? Like you could just zip to any one of those, right? Super central. I see a lot of opportunity there for short-term renting too. But I'm curious. I'm actually looking at this property, putting in an offer today. If it goes through, I'll be out there like next week or so. I'm actually nice. super curious. It's a pretty big home. What the opportunity would be to do it as like a boutique student housing type of thing. Be really curious to get your insight.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to look at. I think, you know, I've heard, and I don't have hard data. I haven't looked into College Station, but I've heard A&M is one of those markets that has a ton of student housing coming on board because, you know, it's an obvious investment, right? Close to all these major hubs, huge student body, you know, higher income student body as well. So I've heard it has a high saturation, but it sounds like you're doing more of a smaller student housing deal, and if you have certain things that really matter to the student body, I think you could definitely have some opportunity.
Location, you know, Mike. My target is actually the Aggie alumni, which
very down to visit their kids, exactly. Go to games and all that. Okay.
Very, you know, A&M has a very faithful following, as I'm sure you know. Oh, right. Man,
too, like, faithful.
For life.
Cultish.
No, yeah, they are. And it would
be a good thing for you if you have a short term rental in that area, right?
Exactly. You know, right by the college. So that's kind of my game plan. But I'm just really curious, you know, what the I always like to have at least one contingency plan, because, you know, as confident as I am, is it being good? Nothing's for sure. So maybe the student body could pitch in and provide some return if it came down to it, you know, just kind of.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Curious.
That's a great idea. Like you said, I mean, that alumni base is probably one of the stronger ones in the entire country.
I agree. Yeah.
When it comes to coming down to all the events, and that's a year round thing, you know?
Yes. Yes. Even in the summer, somehow.
That's right.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Move in, move out too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that.
We'll see how it goes, man. We'll see how it goes.
Good luck. Yeah.
If someone wants to invest with you, and we've thrown around a lot of terms here, GP, LP, co-GP, da-da-da-da-da, and I hope my audience forgives me and not explaining any of those, but long story short, like, you are a second generation real estate investor, and you have hundreds of units to your name that you're managing. So if someone were to put their money with you, it is likely better taken care of than if they tried to do it themselves. And they'll probably get a better return just because it's so easy to lose money in real estate.
Yeah.
Especially for first time investors. But when you partner with a reliable, with a proven track record, you know, your chances of successful return are pretty high. So if someone was interested in investing with you, or at least just having a conversation, or just like following you and getting to know what you do and who you are, what are some ways that they can do that? How can they follow you? How can they get in contact with you?
Yeah, well, on all platforms, my handle is Jordan Da Silva 1. That's JordanDaSilva 1. Unfortunately, the original Jordan Da Silva is already taken on all platforms. I've tried to make offers to get that name, but it doesn't work. But feel free to follow me on, you know, Twitter. I'm active everywhere. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. I'm always sharing content on the journey, on property management, operations, impact, investments. So definitely follow me there. And then to schedule a call, our website is called www.webcityequity.com. So feel free to follow there. That's WEBCITY equity.com. And we can schedule a conversation there to figure out investment goals. And I think for us, you know, if you're looking to invest in somebody that's going to give a great return, but be conservative at every juncture and be operationally efficient at all times, then we're the person for you. We're not going to be the gaudy numbers that says we're going to, you know, 3x, 4x your investment in 2-3 years. We're going to be more of that conservative, solid returns with plenty of upside on the back end. So we really prioritize operational efficiency and being conservative at all times. But, you know, I think we do that while at the same time being impactful. So that's another thing. I think if you're looking for a way to make good returns, but also make a good impact, we're the one to go to. So feel free to follow us on all platforms and then schedule a call on our website.
Awesome, man. Awesome. And when is the next time you think you'll have an investment opportunity? Next 3 months, by the end of the year?
I'm thinking we have some good things in the pipeline right now. I'm thinking in the next couple of weeks. So that'd be good to get some calls in and definitely look forward to sending that out pretty soon.
Awesome. Awesome, man. Jordan, it's been a real pleasure getting to know you, man, and talking with you. So thanks for coming on, dropping some knowledge and just chatting, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate your time, and it's been good to get to know you as well. Love to hopefully meet up in person if you come to Texas and follow up from there.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely.
Yes, sir. All right, man. Take care.